Welcome to series two of Crime Tapes. Now, throughout this series, we're still in a situation where we're dealing with the pandemic. And as a result of that, we're having to record these podcasts in a slightly different way, including from home. So the sound quality might not be that we had in series one. Please do bear with us a little bit on the quality of sound, which throughout the series of episodes, you might find is impacted by the circumstances that we're dealing with. Hi, and welcome to Crime Tapes, a podcast that's made by Staffordshire University in the School of Law, Policing and Forensics, alongside the Centre for Crime, Justice and Security. Here on Crime Tapes, in this series two, we're looking specifically at the topic of policing, and I'm joined by guests each week who have practical experience and backgrounds in policing, who are talking essentially about their experience working in the police and also about the concepts, ideas and topics that inform today's policing. Here at Staffordshire University, in the Institute of Policing and in the Faculty of Law, Policing and Forensics, we deliver an array of different policing-related courses. And those cover all sorts of aspects of policing, from road traffic and criminal law right the way through, in some instances, to the most serious forms of investigation, including the investigation of murder or homicides. Today, I'm joined by Stephen Tonks, a colleague at Staffordshire University, who's got an extensive background in policing to talk about the investigation of homicide. Stephen, thank you ever so much for joining me. And just to start off, could you tell our audience a little bit about your background in the police?
Yep, certainly. My name is Steve Tonks. I worked for both West Midlands and West Mercia Police as a police officer, and the last half of my career, really, I worked in homicide investigation for the last 10 years in the police as a senior investigating officer. Those in the know will recognise the term PIP3, PIP3 SIO, as it's often referred to, at least within policing.
So what is a PIP3 SIO? I mean, lots of people at the moment, I think, are finding that they hear acronyms on television programmes, for example, you know, but often they get lost in the mix. So a PIP3 yep. SIO, SIO is Senior Investigating Officer.
Yeah, it sounds rather grand, and it's something I think that those of us from the SIO community are always keen to emphasise. So when people first join the police in their first couple of years, now on the PCDA programme, they'll qualify to PIP Level 1 to investigate at that level. When people become specialised detectives and follow the detective training route, they'll become PIP Level 2. And then when they develop a little bit more grey hair like me, then they undertake or can undertake training in specific areas. So the PIP3 SIO role now extends not just for major crime, which is where my background is, but it also extends to things like kidnap and extortion and other particular areas of criminality. So my background is major crime.
These would be the most sort of serious crimes, as it were, in some ways, ones that you're likely to hear about in the media. Now, I expect that for a lot of people, when they think about joining or they've heard about the police and they think about it, they think about policing as being this kind of, investigation of, you know, oh, it's catching really, really serious criminals. But that's not the case, really, is it? A lot of you could spend an entire career, as it were, without investigating the more serious offences.
I think it depends on what you call investigating. I think one of the things that I emphasise to the students that I teach now on the PCDA programme in particular, and also the degree holder programme, is that at any one time, a police officer or member of police staff might have quite an important role to play in homicide. So they might be the person taking the call, first attending the scene, putting the scene tape up or whatever it may be, that actually is quite critical to what somebody undertaking the role that I used to have might then come in and investigate and review.
Because every decision can have an implication for the furtherance of that investigation. If things go wrong early on, things can go wrong in a big way, I would assume.
But they can, and you know, it always seems to be the case that the calls into action, if you like, often would take place, you know, in the middle of the night. So the kind of calls that I would get and my colleagues would get, a lot of decisions had already been taken by the attending officers, quite rightly, quite understandably. So they've already started looking at what I would term fast-track action, that sort of golden hour principles, the need to secure evidence and, where necessary, make arrests, seize clothing, identify scene or scenes. All those type of things would ordinarily happen. And all police officers, I think, throughout their service will get the opportunity, I think, to do that. And therefore quite interesting.
And it is interesting in a way. And I suppose, because what we'll move today to talk about some specific cases as well, but I think you're absolutely right in a way that we often sort of think of, and I suppose this is the way that the media portrays the homicide investigation. You know, there is a detective, and we could name any one of fictional representations on television, and they're the person who breaks open the case. But in reality, what you're suggesting is it's very much a team effort, and in some ways that the role that you were playing was more the coordinating role, as it were. But it's not necessarily that you are Morse or Cracker, or I'm not very good on television detectives, but you know, I'm showing my age already. But it is really a role of management of the wide portfolio of the investigation.
Yeah, very much so. There are lots of people who are very highly trained, and I think the skill of a senior investigating officer is coordinating or conducting the different roles. So deciding which areas are going to help you with a particular investigation. So people like a police search advisor, or pulser as it can be termed, or an interview advisor, often referred to in policing as a tier five. So somebody who advises on how witnesses should be interviewed or how suspects should be interviewed. Disclosure officers, forensic managers are all people that will come and assist the senior investigating officer in making decisions. The critical bit for a senior investigating officer is it's the SIO's role really to make decisions following the advice of all the people that I've mentioned. And there are plenty of others. So there are lots and lots of different experts within policing. So within a particular police force, you might have people who are trained to certain levels. There's also a national facility through the College of Policing to receive advice from experts nationally. So there might be experts in, again, search or family liaison or whatever it may be that might help, because in that particular investigation, you might need that. Whereas in another one, it's different skills that you need depending on the circumstances of the case. So it's bringing all that together, listening to it, and trying to find a meaningful way forward that's based. And again, sorry to sort of quote what's in the books, really, but rationale.
Right.
And thinking about, okay, in the context of where you are with an investigation, providing the rationale that justifies the decision that then takes the investigation forward, and then reviewing that to see if that rationale still applies or if actually circumstances have changed.
And a lot of that would also be recording those decisions that you take and your justifications for why you take them as well, because as the other side is, any investigation, I suppose, could be subject to review at some subsequent stage as well, because we kind of again, we sort of think with a lot of investigations, I suppose, that, you know, it's a very kind of linear process. The police, and this is, I think, is where the media kind of representation comes in. The senior investigating officer sweeps in, tells everybody what to do, the offender is caught, it goes through the courts really, really easily, and that ends up with imprisonment, and it's all done and dusted and matter over. But actually, the realities of policing, I think, are not always necessarily that it follows. It can follow a not dissimilar process, but it can be a much more complex one as well.
Yeah, it can. The process of review starts obviously with yourself, really. So checking, you know, that you're happy yourself with the decisions that you've made, consulting very much so that highly likely and highly usual to have a deputy senior investigating officer who, in some cases, knows the intricacies of the case sometimes more than the SIO. You know, so you've got somebody straight away that can support you, advise you, and help you. Internally, then there are review teams, and I think the level of scrutiny that's placed on homicide. You know, you've mentioned some of the cases that are often talked about in the media, and the level of media interest. Media interest is one area of the amount of scrutiny that could be placed on it. And I think if you project that forward to taking cases to trial, which is very much, you know, what what the investigative process is about when you're investigating homicide. Really, from moment one, day one, that's, you know, everything you're doing is you're thinking about, you know, how is this going to affect, you know, a future court case, because that's where, you know, you're hoping that your case will go.
Do you feel, as an investigator, as a senior investigating officer, did you feel very much the pressure of that when you were undertaking the job or the role, that you're there thinking, you know, ultimately this is going to be profile and it's going to end up on, you know, the news at 7 o'clock at night, and you know, the decisions are going to be subjected to scrutiny and people are going to look at this. Is that something you feel kind of acutely as you're working?
Yes, you do. And therefore, that's probably one of the reasons why you spend a lot of time at work in those first few days and subsequently. And it's an ongoing process. So that could be, for example, being accountable, obviously, to the chief officers within the police force, for whom you've got a direct link, who are always very supportive. But they clearly need to know that what you're doing is taking things in the right direction. You've got issues of public confidence then coming into that. So the public need to feel confident that an investigation is being conducted properly and meaningfully. And I think that probably in homicide, you've kind of got the whodunit cases where it's taken a little bit of a while to actually work out who your suspect is.
Yeah.
And you've also got cases where it might be quite obvious who a suspect is, but the challenge is actually more towards demonstrating that what has taken place is or isn't a homicide, or certainly from my understanding, there's a significant amount of legal defences to homicide that might make a case a manslaughter rather than a murder, or it might mean, for example, a self-defence type case. So the circumstances are subject to a great deal of scrutiny. So I mentioned taking cases to court. An awful lot of homicide cases obviously are contested at court. Don't get many people pleading guilty. I can't give any figures on it, but certainly from my experience anyway. Therefore it gets that scrutiny, as you've described.
Absolutely. Well, it's an interesting area because there's a lot of public, I think there's a lot of public misunderstanding as well. One of the things I often do with students and parents when they come to Staffordshire University for open days, for example, is to talk about the police clear up rates when it comes to homicide, which are incredibly high. The police are very, very effective, as it were, in solving. I think the figures have fallen somewhat in recent years, but still well over 90% of all homicides are cleared up in incredibly quickly. And what I often also say, that, you know, that's a credit to the police. And I ask the parents and so on, why is that the case? And one of the myths that quite often comes across is that, you know, the majority of homicides involve a perpetrator who is unknown. Now, that's not to suggest that they don't happen, but actually that's quite a rare form in many ways. A lot of the time, you know, it's two parties that have come across or encountered each other. They do know each other, and it's not necessarily solving, you know, the cunning and ruthless crimes of Professor Moriarty. You know, it's much more the kind of, you know, two young men have had a fight outside a pub, a knife's been produced, and someone's life has ended.
Yes.
And so, but I guess it must be quite an interesting job in some ways, because as you say, you get the call in the early hours of the morning, and I guess, you know, end up very often having to attend a scene or the first thing in the day. It must be a job where you face a lot of variation in role and a lot of different things.
Yeah, very much so. So obviously scenes can vary. Some scenes can be in the open air, often in domestic settings, in people's houses, or in other public places, pubs and those type of locations. So yeah, there's lots of different variation there, and I also think that it's really, really important. I used to emphasise this with a lot of colleagues, really, that all investigators, particularly senior investigating officers and the people that are interviewing suspects, attend scenes and get a good understanding.
Yeah,
because you know, a picture paints 1,000 words. You can look at a photograph of it, but actually, when you're there, you get a sense of the scene itself, because then when you're in an interview or then you're listening to the way a witness might describe what took place, it means more contextually in terms of, you know, what impact that might have on investigation. So you're asking yourself the question, can that witness really see what they purport to have seen from this particular point? All those type of questions. And going back to that scrutiny that you place, you're kind of reviewing that all the time with the evidence. But yeah, lots and lots of variety. lots and lots of different locations to go to, lots of travel involved, lots of traveling across the region, across the force area, sometimes out of force area, depending on the nature of the inquiry.
And I bet it's something that brings you into both into contact with both the best and worst of humanity in some ways as well. Because, I mean, one of the things that has always stayed with me from my time in the criminal justice system is that we often think in a very kind of one-dimensional, linear way about what criminal justice professionals do, as in kind of catching the offenders. But it's also police officers that will be going out to tell the family sometimes of the deceased partner what has happened. It's dealing with the kind of sensitivities of having to deliver horrible news, very often in the worst cases of homicide and so on. It would be doing things like supporting families as well, and through roles like family liaison officer and helping them, because, you know, we should never forget that while we're talking about kind of homicide and it becomes very much offender victim focused, the ripples of that impact in all sorts of walks of different life. And all of that, I assume, is something that you have to be aware of as you're running the investigation. It's beholden to lots of different parties.
Yeah, so, I mean, family liaison, really, really important. It's been an established term in policing, certainly for sort of 25 years or so. I was a family liaison coordinator for more than 10 years with West Mercia Police, and I think it's really critical, because if we move across to that, whatever the percentage is of undetected crimes that, you know, where somebody's not found to be culpable, or where somebody is convicted of manslaughter, when in fact it might well have been a murder, therefore the sentence is different. You know, there's a huge impact on the family. There is obviously a huge impact on the family anyway, and there's an arguable point as to whether the criminal justice system ever goes anywhere near redressing any of that. Mm-hmm. That's a different debate, really, for a different day. But it's really, really, really important. And that wider impact then, thinking about the community, so the community might be, in some cases, quite local, might be national, so that there's lots of cases you know, that have a national impact and get reported on nationally, but also internationally. And then, you know, this day and age, we start to think now about the community being more of a virtual community.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, because the nature of social networks.
Absolutely. We've seen that you know, that, for example, you know, police conduct in one context. And I think, you know, about things like the case of Officer Derek Chauvin and the George Floyd case, for example, can have huge implications in different settings. So when the police are under scrutiny, it can put all police under scrutiny, even if it exists outside of the kind of first immediate context. Which brings me on to talking the sort of specifics a little bit of cases and so on, because I think it's interesting. We often hear about cases but then don't have someone who's experienced or knows things about them to talk about them. Obviously, we said when things go wrong, or where they don't necessarily get solved, that's very often the issues where the most controversy is caused. And in particular, you know, perhaps if we looked to the UK, some of the greatest controversies in policing have been those unsolved or problematic homicides in recent years. One of those that I've seen kind of heavily described and debated is the murder of the TV presenter Jill Dando. I mean, I'm not going to get into asking you the specifics of what you think about, you know, Barry George's case or the likes. But a case like that, do you have some sympathy with those who acted as senior investigating officers in it? Because you understand what it is to investigate that kind of case. And I guess the difficulties in a way that many of us just don't see.
You make me sound in quite a sort of privileged position. What I would say is that each case has its own particular factors. In that particular case, again, a huge amount of media interest, so the pressure that you and I spoke about a short time ago, but also in that particular case, there were an awful lot of lines of inquiry that came in quite quickly. Mm-hmm. And part of the method of investigation is to try to determine hypotheses. So to try to realistically explain from the evidence and from the information, from the intelligence, what might have taken place.
Right.
And I think my sympathy in that particular case was obviously trying to, officers really trying to work through a significant amount of potential information and identify the bits that might have actually, you know, sought to solve the case, including the fact that, you know, we don't know from that case, for example, about forensic evidence as to whether that was available, but the paramedics would have attended, as they do with all initial reports, and try and treat the casualty. And of course, by doing so, they could quite understandably legitimately compromise the scene. Their priority must always be, and we teach this again to the police officers, to save life, preserving life. That's far more important than anything else. You know, and so we'll never know, and the senior investigating officers in that case will never know if there was anything that might have been recovered in different circumstances. So there are lots and lots of different factors. But yeah, certainly a very challenging case. But I think the legacy that cases like that leave, the fact that we're still talking about it now, and the fact that, you know, I don't think there's a force in the country that hasn't got some sort of a case that doesn't have some sort of a legacy attributable to it because of, you know, what we're talking about here.
Absolutely. And I guess, again, that must be an acute sense you carry with you as an SIO, Steve, when you're thinking, you know, if this goes wrong, in a way, it's very often, because I think as a society we do this, the blame often gets pinned to individuals, doesn't it? And it can be quite unforgiving.
It tends to hit you, really, James, when you're in Crown Court and the announcement comes over on the public address system that the jury have returned a verdict. Because you may have been in court in some cases several weeks or several months with a case, having worked on a case for, in some cases, years.
Yeah.
But when that happens, obviously everything is in the hands of normally 12 people of the jury who return in a verdict on the case. And that short walk from the public foyer into the courts to then...
It can feel like a very long one.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely, it can, and that's where you are. And you know, usually, normally, it comes back in favour, because obviously you mentioned the detection rates. Sometimes it doesn't, and it's hard then, because the system in this country doesn't allow any interrogation of any jury members to understand what were the factors that they might have taken into account during the case. Yeah. So there's an element of educated guesswork, professional judgment being applied by yourself, Crown Prosecution Service, prosecution lawyers, etc., all the way through the process. But that's when it tends to hit you.
Well, it's a difficult one as well, because legally, and I guess this is something that some of our listeners may not know. I watched something on television the other day where it was a program called 24 Hours in Police Custody, which I think a lot of viewers in the UK have seen, where there were questions about a case of homicide, and ultimately it proved very, very difficult to prove the causal link between the offender's conduct. And no disputing that the death happened, but actually sometimes, even medically, it's very, very difficult, for example, to prove. So someone could be seriously, very, very badly assaulted, for example, and die afterwards. And we may say, you know, well, he wouldn't have died otherwise. But if that death was from, for example, cardiac arrest, and the person is shown to have a weak heart, it can be very difficult then to suggest the causal intent for the offender that makes it a case of murder rather than manslaughter, or, as you say, an assault. So it's a complex legal terrain that you have to understand as well, isn't it?
It is. My last two cases before I retired involved cardiac events, where the causation between the criminality, if you like, we look at the manslaughter cases, and therefore, as long as a criminal offence is either an assault or a public order offence is set out, you've got to then look for that causal link. So I mentioned earlier about, you know, people that can help you, experts, so pathologists, cardiologists, lots of ologists that can actually support what, you know, or essentially just try and establish what the truth of the matter is, you know, and that's what it's about. For each of those two cases, one of them led to the conviction of two people for manslaughter in a road rage type incident, but the person died from a cardiac event immediately following what had taken place. In the second case, which was a dispute between two neighbours, there'd been some sort of dispute and possible fisticuffs, probably no more than that, but it had led to a fatal cardiac event, and the suspect, following lengthy investigation, lengthy trial, was acquitted. And actually, in that case, we actually felt at the end of it that it was the right result. And far more importantly, you go back to talking about the family and standing there when the jury come in and being nervous, really, that the family of the victim, they were in agreement as well. They could understand that the way that the jury had arrived at their decision. It's quite interesting. The jury were deliberating for several days and returned a majority rather than a unanimous decision. But again, you know, it's the fact that all of the evidence was discussed, played out in court, listened to, debated by defence and prosecution, was part of a, you know, an important process. And I think in homicide investigation, cases can go to court, whereas when we're looking in wider criminal justice and looking at other offences, some of the criticism that can happen towards the police is, well, the case hasn't got to court and it's never really had its day in court, to coin a old-fashioned phrase.
Yeah. And it's interesting because the aspect that you brought in there is very much a kind of an investigation process that's ultimately about finding the truth, as it were, and presenting all of the evidence. So it's kind of trying to go out and find that which might allow you to kind of reconstruct what has happened, which again, I suppose it's that in and of itself is challenging and difficult, given that it will never just be the other thing that I think that the media often shows, which kind of creates this distorted picture, is that very often you're dealing with more than one of these cases at any one time, aren't you? So as a senior investigating officer, what would a caseload look like?
To an extent, it depends on judgment. So each force will have a number of senior investigating officers. It isn't just necessarily down to one person, although I think the in the last few years, however long a few years, we'll say 10 just for the sake of the conversation, there's been lots and lots of conversations about police resourcing. So major investigation, as with other areas of policing, has taken its hit, if I can term it that way, in terms of resource availability. It's quite common for senior investigating officers and their team to be managing a number of cases at different stages. What happens in practice is, if in one particular area happens to be an awful lot of homicides, then people can be brought in from elsewhere, normally within the same police force, but then from the wider region if that's what's necessary. And there have been certain times and certain years where, you know, it's been very, very difficult. In the West Midlands, for example, quite a number of years ago, there were quite a number of, shooting incidents, all happened at the same sort of time, placing a significant amount of stress on, obviously, the resource capability for what in every individual case is a really, really serious event.
And those are often as well some of the harder cases, aren't they? Because it's often when you get into that realm of kind of the more sort of serious organised crime connected aspects that people are more aware and savvy about things like evidence trails. They're better at taking those kind of preventative mechanisms.
Yes.
Those offences might well be well planned out, but that degree of planning means that for an investigator, it's going to create more difficulty in terms of looking into them and following the evidence trail, as it were.
And witnesses are more impacted in terms of whether they want to come forward.
Yeah.
If they do come forward, what that might mean for them in terms of, you know, whether they might have to relocate or, are they going to suffer any future consequence as a result of being a witness in a serious case, as you've outlined. So there's lots and lots of aspects to that, yeah.
And all these things are those that you have to kind of take into account. Now, it's often not the case, I think, that the public, the topic is one that absolutely fascinates people. So I see a huge amount of media kind of, and it is interesting in that there is now kind of more media following kind of police detective working. The BBC Two have tied up with the Open University, for example, and said about 24 hours in police custody. So there is perhaps a greater insight now than there has been at times. But still, I can think of few accounts where senior investigating officers have kind of come forward and given accounts of themselves, and when they do, they can be it can be a kind of celebrated few, and it can be people who've worked in difficult or different, quite unusual cases. Sometimes one of those that I remember was Steve Fulcher, I think it was, who was involved in two murder cases involving a chap called Chris Halliwell. And I remember that one particularly because it created a big debate and discussion about the ethics of conduct, didn't it? When you were working and operating within the police, were things like that well known about? Were senior investigating officers such as him, did that case in particular have an impact or a fallout for yourself?
Well, it's certainly caused people again to reflect, because the issue in the case, to the best of my understanding, I don't have a detailed understanding of the case, and I would certainly say as well that it's not my place to judge the actions of a fellow officer who's making a dynamic decision effectively.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
What the decision led to in the way that he dealt with Halliwell immediately following an arrest was obviously consideration around whether or not the code of practice had been breached or not, and what that then meant in terms of admissibility of the evidence that then was given. And
just so people know, what essentially happened in that case is Chris Halliwell had been traced, and ultimately he was involved in a murder and an abduction and a homicide, and he was taken out to reveal where the body from that homicide was, and he did reveal that to the SIO, to Fulcher in that case, didn't he? And it was before they then returned to the police station that he then turned to Fulcher and said, "And do you want another one? Oh, this is the allegation that I understand." And then ultimately, I think the thing that comes out of it, and Fulcher's written his autobiography because it became a kind of particularly profile case, but ultimately he did then recover another body and another murder victim. But the circumstances surrounding that, and particularly I think the failure to kind of then caution him and take him back to the station, people kind of suggested that it put the case in jeopardy. And yet at the same time, to be fair, because I'm you know, talking both sides, the family of the second victim felt that, and still do, I understand, that Fulcher was the best detective ever, because he delivered the answer to an unknown for them. So, but he faced some sanction for what he'd done.
He did, yeah. And it demonstrates really the position that the SIO is in that I outlined earlier, in that there have to be decisions made, and those decisions can be trying to find a way through circumstances that might not have been faced before.
Yeah.
Or if they have, maybe not in quite the same context. So he had to make a decision. He made a decision. It led to the recovery of a second murder victim's body, for which I understand the family are eternally grateful, a great deal of public outpouring in support of the decision that he made, yet within the legal system. And it's certainly not my place to comment on decisions made at court. What ultimately happened, however, was, you know, that evidence was inadmissible, and therefore that murder is technically undetected.
Yeah.
It just demonstrates that wicked position that you're in.
It's a hugely complex case. I read Fulcher's autobiography quite a while ago while I was on holiday, which is where I kind of became aware of it. And it strikes me as that's kind of classic case of where in some ways morality, ethics and law are necessarily not always they don't always line up perfectly. You know, what the right thing to do and what the legal thing to do may be questioned. But of course, he did face the consequences. He ultimately wasn't dismissed from the police but he was he faced disciplinary proceedings, and for quite some time I think faced the potential that he might be really severely sanctioned for what he'd done. I think again the thing we can say here is these are things that for a lot of people are not going to be faced in a day today kind of working world. So it must create real stress for you, Steve, when you're thinking, you know, oh my god, at any given moment I could how did you kind of cope with working in that environment?
I'm smiling when you're describing that, James, simply because it's one of those situations where you can imagine everybody's got somebody else that they can go to in the chain to ask and consult with, but really the senior investigating officer is the person at the end of that chain.
Yeah.
So they are the person making that decision. Yes, they can consult, and yes, they can seek advice, and yes, they can try to see if anybody else has ever been in the same position and all that type of stuff. But ultimately, you are nailing your colours to the mast and saying, this is my decision in this context, and I've got to stand or fall on the basis of that decision. In terms of how you cope, I don't know an answer to that. You just recognise that that's the position that you're in, and make sure that the rationale that you have for that decision reflects the context in which you're making it to the best of your ability. And then, you know, yeah. It might be later down the line that has to be reviewed. And as human beings, you might look back at some decisions that you make and think, you know, do you know what, I might have made a bit of a different decision, or I might have dealt with it in a different way. But it's hard then, once the decision's been made, particularly in that situation, to then go back to it. But that's the job.
A very different question in some ways. I think I'd speak to a lot of people, and indeed, even this weekend, I was talking to a colleague who's a senior teacher, and they said, you know, I quite fancied a career change, and I'd like to be a police investigator. I know you work with the police, James. Yeah, I'd like to be a police investigator, but I could never do that. And I kind of said, well, why could you never do that? Just kind of interested in, but one of the things I obviously don't know is I having not been as you, Steve, I don't know what would you say makes someone a really good investigator? What are you looking for in some ways that as that potential?
I think what we're looking for are people that are organized, people that that are good communicators. I think, you know, some of the there are lots and lots of different methods now, and lots of devices and methods of communication, but ultimately it's a process of talking to people. Mm. So whether you're talking face to face over screen, which is a lot of how investigations are done in the current context, or talking to people in a room, so there's a big element of that. And also people that recognize what we're talking about in terms of, you know, where the rules and policies are. I'm not saying they've got to be too strict to it, but again, everybody working in the team for a senior investigating officer representing me effectively as the senior investigating officer, so important that I demonstrate, you know, what my standards and ethics are, but, you know, done in a way that trusts people, trusts experienced detectives, and trusts people that are new as detectives that want to come into investigation. You know, the police, in my experience, generally recruit the right kind of people who are doing it for the right reason. Still got to have that element of, you know, what we've talked about, public interest, public confidence, and be driven by that, and making sure really that at the end of the day, when you're in court, when you're meeting a family as a detective, doesn't really matter what rank you are or what your role is, that you can answer questions and you can answer honestly about the way things have been done.
That's a really interesting one, because everything you've just described, it strikes me as very, very different often from the dramatic kind of representations of, sure. You know, particularly I'm thinking of, you know, the kind of detective figures that you get either in fiction or in fiction in a kind of visual form. They're very often maverick, loner, hard to relate, difficult kind of characters that you get a grumpy person to play. You know, that's not what you're describing at all, though. It really is at quite odds. One other question is, when you come across those kind of fictional representations, given the role that you've had, do you try and come across them, or do you think that they're awful and tend to try and avoid, or does it take your ability to
yeah, it takes my ability to watch any sort of drama about it, and it doesn't represent you know, what it's really like, unfortunately. If I hope that doesn't burst anybody's bubble.
No,
about
I find it often I'm entirely the same. My wife gets really annoyed with me, because I tend to shout at the television and kind of dismiss the kind of factual basis and the elements, particularly at and around anything that features prison. And, you know, it's so far away from the kind of realities of what happens.
I think that's just the price we pay, isn't it?
It is. Yeah, it is one of the things I think that we kind of then get, you know, it's nothing like that. But it is interesting the way it's kind of portrayed against the reality. And I think in some ways that might stand as a bit of a barrier for people to kind of think, you know, this is something that I'd like to do. But was it a career that you found fulfilling, and did you enjoy your time in the police?
Yeah, very much so. I remember the first incident room, that's a bit of police jargon, so the sort of Holmes incident rooms get set up that I worked on, where and I was never aware of the term when I was in the police, but now I'm in the world of academia, aware of this term teaming, where people will come together from different backgrounds and are all on sort of one common cause, if you like, and which would be the investigation, and I really enjoyed that feeling of coming together with people from different backgrounds within the police and working in that sort of incident room environment. So I was always drawn towards that. Absolutely fascinating career. Lots and lots of good days, some not so good days, some very, very challenging days and long days, but always interesting, always varied.
Yeah.
And generally a sense that what you were doing did help and did impact and did contribute towards that, even when there were cases that you either couldn't prosecute or were not going to lead actually to somebody being convicted. That was part of the process, but not necessarily the outcome. And I think the way that policing is changing, you know, when I joined the police back in the late 80s, it was very much about catching baddies and putting them in prison, and that was the sort of focus of it. Yeah. A lot more focus now very much on protecting vulnerable people, keeping people from harm, safeguarding, all those type of things. But integral to that is still investigation.
Yeah.
You know, what service do the police offer? In my personal opinion, it's still the ability to investigate as thoroughly as possible with a view to try to, you know, bring people into court where the evidence exists.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that is really, really interesting, because that sort of shifting function of policing is something we've talked about previously. But as you say, there is always and ever going to be, even as the police get better at picking up and dealing with wider vulnerabilities and so on, there is always going to be that need to investigate in some instances the very, very serious and sometimes very upsetting crimes. On that basis, I think final one I'd like to ask you about, because I think again it touches on something, which is that for a lot of people, I think that they think one of the reasons I couldn't join the police is because of that kind of upsetting and emotional aspect of what you encounter. What would you say to people when they kind of said that? Because you've obviously had to go through those things. Is it something that is a barrier, or have the police got better at recognising and supporting people?
The police have certainly recognised in more recent times the need to do it. All forces will have welfare provision. It isn't just an off-the-shelf sort of product that sort of conveniently solves a problem, but I think we've got to ask ourselves a question, what is it we're joining the police to do, which is to... Mm-hmm. Serve, protect, make a difference, protect people from harm. But where people have been harmed, in this case, and what we're talking about here, people have been killed, doing our very best for the people that are then impacted by that, usually the family, but also the wider community. Yeah. And I would say to anybody, who else rather than you, who's better than you? You know, everybody draws on their life skills, but, you know, what everybody else is the same. They're all human beings. We all don't like seeing some of the things that we have to see. And we all drive home sometimes and are reflecting on what we've seen. And then when we get home, we're not necessarily involved in the most engaged conversation with our partners because of what we've experienced. And those are the sort of experiences from my time, you know. But that's how it impacts on you. But it does have an effect. I think it'd be strange to say not, but it can be managed. Also, you've got quite a good network in the police. We do talk about some of our students about organisational culture and the benefits of that. And you know, the police are still a team. They're perhaps structured in different ways, and that changes quite a lot. But ultimately, there's lots of police officers around you who know what it feels like, who have experienced some of the things that you've experienced. So there's often people to talk to. And in my experience, there's plenty of support from colleagues, you know, to at least have those conversations, and then to recognise, you know, if people actually need more than just conversation.
So is it a career that you'd recommend to people still?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I am quite envious of some of the young students who are joining that I'm teaching online at the moment, but I'd love to be back in the position that they're in. It's nice when I get to teach them, because it reminds me very much of me being in the same position, and that's the reason why I moved into this role and what I enjoy about it. So yeah, I would highly recommend it.
No, that's absolutely great. Steve, that is absolutely fascinating, and thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today. I'm sure that people listening are going to think, what a fascinating subject. And while we've barely scratched the surface about all the things that we could talk about, I'm sure in the investigation of serious crime. And so I will undoubtedly get you back at some point in the future, if that's okay.
It is. Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. Thank you so much for listening to us today. You've been listening to Crime Tapes, a podcast made by Law Policing and Forensics at Staffordshire University. If you're interested in any of our policing courses, do have a look at our website. We run a range of different courses, both pre-graduate, graduate, postgraduate, for policing related subjects. Do have a look on the web. And similarly, if you're interested in this podcast, do check out the others that we've made, which are available through Buzzsprout and all the usual podcast channels. All that it remains for me to do is to once again thank Steve and say I look forward to joining you again at some point on Crime Tapes.